Polly and Sam's and Jerry and Debbie are here, and we're talking Dogen and just a slight amount of Trevor. And here's a story that either Polly or IRA told about Del Sieta, right?
Ron's
going to tell. Oh, you're going to tell about the toys?
Well, I thought I told about it.
Well, we're getting it on tape now, and you're telling Jerry and Debbie.
Oh,
Sam
well,
might have heard it, I don't know.
Del Sieta lived at the farm when I was a little boy. And all I remember is this very, very old lady. And all, she was my grandma. And I remember limping around the house, and I thought she was awful mean. And the reason I thought she was mean was because she tried to take toys away from me. And I understand that she said that if a child can't pick up his toys, he doesn't deserve to have them. So I didn't think much of Grandma. And so after she died, my parents, Wes and Eunice, found the whole dresser drawer full of toys that she put up and hidden from us.
So her death was probably a great joy to you guys, because all of a sudden you had your toys, a lot of toys back.
Well, I'm so happy to see some of her younger pictures now, or over the years.
Yeah, all we've had is that terribly old one in the sunbonnet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a younger,
very grim.
There's even this younger one, she looks grim.
Yeah.
But I have a next generation story that matches that, which has to do with Jerry, although he probably doesn't know this story, which is that you and Mother went down to Bosworth's and brought back a load of furniture from Bosworth's down in Elgin. And when you came back with this various furniture that you had bought from the Bosworth's, you brought back a whole barrel of toys, discards from the Bosworth kids. And some of them were no good and broken, and others were in good shape, and there was that big bear that went, that was on wheels, and it had one broken wheel. We adored that bear. And you could practically ride it. I mean, you could ride it. It was on wheels and so forth, and then you'd pull the string on its back. It was a wire metal with a wire ring, and you'd pull it out, and the bear would go, but the wheel was never fixed, so you couldn't coast on it very well. You'd have to sort of keep your weight to one side so that the wheel wouldn't stop you and so forth.
I remember.
And then there was this barrel full of toys, and what they did is they put them upstairs over the milk house in the apartment up there, which at the moment was empty, and told us kids that there they were. And it was like Christmas to go up there and to go into this barrel of toys that had come from the Bosworths. And there was one that Patty just adored, which was a little tin woman about so high, pushing, and you'd wind her up. She was a wind-up toy, and you'd wind her up, and she was pushing a carpet sweeper. And she was Busy Lizzie, and she was on some sort of wheels on the bottom, and she'd go around like this, you see, on the carpet with the carpet sweeper. And that was Patty's favorite, was Busy Lizzie. And there was some old funny papers in there from, you know, way back, really. Little Nemo and things like that, funnies that we didn't know, but that Mother knew from earlier years. And the marvelous thing about having all those toys up over the milk house in this empty space was that nobody made us clean them up. And so you didn't have to clean those toys up. You'd just go up and you'd play with them, and then you could go off and leave them in whatever mess they were. And we played with them for a year or more. I forget how long it was. And then I suppose while we were at the lake one summer, because I can't imagine it happening otherwise, we came back and there was nothing up there. They were gone. And at the time, I don't know as we were given a satisfactory answer of what had happened to them, but what had happened to them is that Eunice, Grandma Dogen, had decided that we kids had had those toys long enough, and that it was Jerry and Carla's turn to have them. And so they had loaded up these toys and taken them down to Jerry and Carla. Do you remember getting some toys?
Well, appreciate
well, now that is the story, and it may be apocryphal. They may have vanished in some other way. But that was the story, that Grandma Dogen felt that Jerry and Carla had not gotten their due. And so the toys went down there.
Yeah.
Now, maybe when your mother and father got them, they looked them over and said, well, these are just junk, and threw them out without bothering to give them to you and Carla. Because I'm sure that we had added considerable wear to the...
Probably a fortune.
Oh, right now they'd be worth
it. They'd probably slip them, two of them, one at a time or something.
Well, I don't know.
I can't imagine giving kids the barrel of
oil. I think I'd remember busy fishing.
Well, I know what happened to the bear. The bear vanished. And somehow the bear found its way to the men on the farm. And the bear ended up on a post halfway down to the creek in the middle of the night, and they scared John Baker to death with it.
Now, isn't the space where the toys were kept, it wasn't that Baker's apartment?
Yeah.
What later became their
apartment? Yeah. See, they maybe needed that apartment for something at that point, and maybe that's why they cleared the toys. But the story I got, and now that Mother's dead, I can't ask her, but she's the one that told me, I'm sure, because I wouldn't have heard it from Eunice.
It was John Baker. He was the butt of a lot of jokes around the farm. Took himself very seriously. He was a Seventh-day Adventist, I think.
You think? Of course he was. We used to slip his kids bacon. Which they were always very happy to get.
The men around the farm or anybody who think of something to pull on John, they would. One that I remember particularly was that we had a toilet off of the milk house. I mean, it was a milk house building. And the door on it was just a half a door, and you couldn't see over it, but you could see under it. And John would always come out there and use that toilet about the same time every morning.
And always in a hurry.
Always in a hurry. So some of the men got a pair of boots and put them on the floor in front of the toilet.
Tall rubber boots.
And then locked the door from the inside. John came rushing out and used the facilities, or the door was locked, and then he see these boots underneath. Then he'd go back for a few minutes and come rushing. Oh, the poor guy.
Well, they pulled all sorts of them on John. I remember that clearly.
The nurse was Mr. Pearson, and he was a Seventh-day Adventist. Mm-hmm. And I was with him on that trip.
Were you?
I came to him. We stayed in a hotel.
I've got a picture of Neil. Have you seen it? Standing out in front of the big house, down the dairy. He's reaching way over here with his right hand. The back of his neck. Silliest picture you'd imagine.
He had long arms.
What?
He had long arms.
And legs from those pictures I've seen in there now.
Well.
Yeah. Now, thinking over those two albums that I saw yesterday, I guess it was, I didn't see any pictures of Aunt Della in there. I saw beautiful pictures of Lillian as a young woman and of Ida as a young woman, but where's Della? I must have missed them. Ethel? Lots of pictures of Ethel. Jerry is giving some information of all that they can gather from the guy. Go on.
John Dogan first emigrated from Ireland to upstate New York. And it was looked like a very unlikely place to emigrate to. It was in the Catskills, the foothills of the Catskills. Mm-hmm. The town is Johnsburg, which is right across the southern Vermont border, just in New York. That can't be a very good farm. But he emigrated in 1818 and then married this McGivney, Elizabeth McGivney.
Who was his first cousin.
And who was born America, around 1800, 1801. So it was apparently the McGibbonys were all living there in this kind of Scotch-Irish enclave in upstate New York, near Johnsville. And then in 1845, they all just picked up and left. And they came to Wisconsin by way of waterway, the Erie Canal and the Great Lakes, and they debarked in Milwaukee in May of 1845.
Headed west a little.
A little, yeah. It would probably seem like a lot in those days, but they didn't have to go very far. But it took them that long to finally wind up in a propitious land that looks at least as good as Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, you wonder why, first of all, what the attraction was, why they wound up in New York and why they stayed. I suppose they stayed because there's nothing.
Well, they would have probably come into New York Harbor or else into Montreal.
They could have come in through Canada. Mm-hmm. I think that's about equally accessible.
And then they might have worked their way down.
Or they could have come from Boston.
Where was he born? In Belfast?
We don't know. It just says he came from Belfast, but that he could have just been come from the port of Belfast.
And do we have a birth date on him?
1797.
That's the guy I'm thinking about. He didn't come to the United States until 1818. So.
That's right. So he was already 21 years old.
I always thought that he came into New York, but I have no reason to believe it.
Well, I think in that particular location, it could very well have been through Canada. A lot of them did come through Canada. But there wasn't much going on in Ireland at the time.
Well, what there was going on in Ireland in the summer of 1816, which might have discouraged him, is that there was a famine.
They had a number of famines before the big one.
And the famine in 1816 was widespread. It was also in Germany and what was all across the Northern Hemisphere and Vermont. They called it 1800 and froze to death because they had to break the ice on the horse troughs on the 4th of July.
That was a harsh winter then, 16 or 18.
It wasn't the winter, it was the summer. That it froze all summer. And they didn't know it then, but it was the equivalent of nuclear winter, which was that there had been a tremendous volcanic explosion, which had caused the summer to be cold all over the Northern Hemisphere.
Was that the one in Indonesia?
I'm not sure if it was Krakatoa or not. It seems to me that was later. But, and didn't seem to have such devastating effect, but it was a volcanic summer, winter summer. And, but they might not necessarily have known. And it might have just been the final straw on things in Ireland. So that after the summer of 1816, why a young man like John might have said, well, I think I'm going to get on over there. And by the time he got himself together, why?
Well, he must have come over. I think he probably came to that spot because there were friends of the family, the McGibbonys.
Well, those were cousins. Those were family. They weren't just friends of the family.
Right.
It was family.
That's right. There was family.
So that the first Dogon that was over was John. But our first relative that was over must have been on the McGibbony side.
Sure.
Elizabeth's parents. And I wonder when they came.
Well, the historian.
What does Mother say? She gives the two sides, the John and
Elizabeth McGibbony was born in this country in 1801. So they were still here. And mm-hmm. she was born in Johnsburg.
New York?
Yeah.
So Samuel McGibbony and Mariah Buchanan must have been over here when Elizabeth was born. But now wait, Arthur Dogon, was he over in Ireland? Was John the one that came over?
John was the one that came over. Arthur didn't come over. Unless you can find him buried there in Johnsbury. I bet there's some McGibbony tombstones in Johnsbury.
Well then Arthur McGibbony married first Sarah Buchanan and then Mariah Buchanan. And
brothers marry sisters?
Cousins marry, I think. Siblings.
Well, Arthur married sisters, first one, and then Sarah apparently died, and then he married Mariah, because Samuel McGivney must have died. Because I rather doubt there would have been a divorce. But then Elizabeth had the interesting situation when she married John of having her mother also be her mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Well, come, you better come look. Here's Samuel McGivney, mm-hmm. married Mariah Buchanan. Mm-hmm. Arthur Dogan married Sarah Buchanan, sisters. Mm-hmm. Sarah dies.
Uh-huh.
Something happens to Samuel,
uh-huh.
and Arthur marries Mariah.
Okay.
Now, Elizabeth is born in the United States
mm-hmm.
in 1802 or something like that. John comes over from Ireland and marries Elizabeth. They're first cousins.
So in other words, the children are old enough to marry from the families.
Well, these would have been already over here. But as far as we know, Arthur and Mariah stayed in Italy, in Ireland. And John came over. You see, and I don't know how many of the others came over or not. But he married his cousin Elizabeth. But meanwhile, Elizabeth's mother by then probably had married Arthur. And if she hadn't, she was going to at some point, which would then make Elizabeth's mother also her mother-in-law. And John's mother-in-law also his stepmother.
You really need a chart.
What?
You really need the chart like that.
Yeah.
Can't explain
well, it's
that
fun
way.
To find you this interested in it, Jerry, too. Because I find it so fascinating to try to figure it out.
So many people have trouble going first cousin, second cousin, or first cousin once removed. They have trouble with that. It's so simple.
My Jillian has it all down. She can explain any family relationship.
It looks like duck soup to me,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well,
he's my first cousin
nuclear.
Once removed.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And Jerry is your first cousin once removed.
Okay. And I'm second cousins to Jerry, and I'm second
and to
cousins
me.
To
mm-hmm.
Jackie and her siblings. Because Ron and my dad were first cousins.
And you
yeah.
see, she,
yeah.
Polly is your second cousin.
So what I
want to
know is why is duck soup supposed to be easy rather than hard?
It's probably very hard if you've ever tried to get meat off a duck carcass.
The once removed designation, is that referred to a generation apart?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it works either way.
Up or down.
Whether you're looking up or
I'm
whether you're
I'm his first
down.
Cousin once removed, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he's my first cousin once removed.
Mm-hmm.
So number we moved is generation.
I don't think
sense.
Ron and Dad look very much alike, do you?
So
no.
that,
At least a
on the other hand,
the
second cousin would be no generation gap.
No.
But two families apart. Good example.
Well, the fact
cousin.
The matter is that Jerry's father and my father were first cousins. Jerry and I are second cousins. Jerry's father and I are first cousins. Ron.
Weird.
Hmm? Ron and I are first cousins once removed. Trevor and I are first cousins once removed.
Yeah, but you and Jerry and I are all second cousins.
Yeah.
No removed.
Yeah. No, you and Jerry are first cousins.
That's right. Jerry and I are first cousins and you are our second cousin.
Right.
Right.
A common second cousin.
But you know, as I look around, I see all these second cousins that I have never even heard of, much less know.
Yeah.
And I think yet here we've always been close to Polly. And how is it that some second cousins are very close relations and other second cousins are totally lost? Like Pat Roney was your first cousin, Dad. So Trevor Roney out there in Seattle that I just discovered is my second cousin and of the same relation to me as Polly.
You have to be good friends as well as related. Mm-hmm. That's
yep.
the
and
some
ge-
occasion
geography.
To get together.
Geography has
mm-hmm. But what made?
But you know the Beaver Dam crowd. It just kind of went off on a separate path, and there really wasn't much contact with them at all, was there?
Now, why did you keep in contact with Fry?
Was that a relative?
Yeah.
Fry is one of the sisters of...
We told her
we
couldn't see her this
She's a cousin of...
Maybe the Needhams.
F-R-U-I, I think.
Maybe the Needhams.
Fanny, it's Fanny Fry.
Fanny Fry.
Where's
Frances
Fry?
Lucille. She married... Fanny. She married Leon Fry.
Now, is she a first cousin of Dad's or a second cousin?
She is a first cousin.
See, now that's quite a close relationship.
No. She's a second cousin. Her dad, John W., is her dad, who is was Grandpa's cousin.
First cousin. So that makes you and Fanny Fry second cousins.
Well, you'd ask why we moved the buildings up around in there. I think it was through the Needhams. We knew the Needhams and then well. And when we were visiting the Needhams, when my father was visiting the Needhams, like Manelli and Jenny and so forth, they referred to it.
But it's interesting why some of the relatives were kept in touch with and other relatives weren't. Why we knew the Needhams and why we knew Viola and Leonora. And why Fanny Fry.
I think Viola and Leonora were so interested in family, they were like Lillian.
That
very
might have been.
In family. As a matter of fact,
and
there's a lot of
Polly,
correspondence
as far as your,
between
the rest
Lillian
of your family.
And Leonora
I don't
and Viola.
Scarcely know, well, there's you and Dorothy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That have stayed close.
Pat and I were talking about that this summer. She said, well, I don't feel as if I really know the boy, Dovis. I said, well, I suppose it's because our sister Dorothy kind of took ownership of him. And then you felt that you couldn't be acquainted with him, too. And Dorothy traveled with Grandmother. She and Grandmother, Della were just like this. Your little Dorothy and everything. And Grandmother put a lot of favors on Dorothy that she didn't have the time to do with the rest of us.
But then there was you, that you were closest our age.
Well, I came out to Beloit with Grandmother once, too. Mm-hmm. When Dorothy was married and gone, I did that little trip.
And then I came to Mason City and saw you.
And you became about my age.
And then you and Joanne got to be friends.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember if that's when you were going with Jim or was it before then. I have the feeling that we knew you before then.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I knew you before then.
Yes, you knew me before then.
Because I knew you when I was 10, and apparently earlier than that when you came out with Grandma, when Uncle Neil was in the wheelchair.
Oh, that was with Aunt Ethel. Before Grandmother had died. She died in 44, Della did. Jim and I were married in May, and Grandma died in September.
You knew Craig only sort of heard of
him. Well, from the visits, I stayed with them when I went to Beloit for dances. So, yeah.
I just remember you one time in Beloit, when you were in college in Rockland.
Uh-huh.
And you came out there to be with Jim.
Mm-hmm.
He gave the house and picked you up and off you went for dance somewhere or something.
Yeah, college dances.
Well, I was impressed with Uncle Neil sitting there in his wheelchair because I'd never heard of a stroke before.
Mm-hmm.
And here was this man sitting there sort of like a vegetable and with the robe over him. And I've still got that picture in my mind. It was at the end of the sidewalk there of the big house, Grandpa. Right where you would have turned to go to the front porch and in that way. But right at the end of that privet hedge is where the picture in my mind is of Uncle Neil sitting there in a... I don't know.
How did he accept this stroke business?
Well, it affected his mind a little, and his humor went to his doggerel poetry, which he could spiel off very easily and readily. And a serious side he no longer had, it seemed. Mm-hmm.
Did he realize that he was chair-bound and so forth?
Yeah, but as I said, it affected his mind, too, and he just... You know how a mongoloid or something is a very cheerful, happy person. I mean, that's kind of the way he was. The Lord had blessed him with...
Was that, where was Ethel at this time? Has she been there?
No, she was along. She decided to take Neil on a trip. He wanted to go on a trip. She wanted to go on a trip.
So she took care of him.
Hired the nurse, the male nurse. He did the driving. carried our suitcases and everything. It was kind of a nice way to travel, I must say.
Chauffeured and everything?
Yes. We went all the way up to, Duluth and then around. And I think we went to Ely, Minnesota too, Duluth and around. And we might have gone out to Mackinac Island, I'm not sure. Down Michigan, across on a boat at Ludington, Ferry. And you know, you get out in Lake Michigan, you can't see shore, it's just like an ocean.
Yeah.
And then we went to Elgin, and then we came to Beloit, and then we went back to Mississippi.
Your kids were a little bit scared of Eunice, of your great-grandma, because her hands were sort of scrawny, and she would grab you and want to hold you close. And both you and, I can remember both you and Megan, submitting to her caresses, but being just a little
scared.
Unhappy about it. And it would be at the house down on Milwaukee Road, and I would bring the girls in. And she didn't die until the year we were living at the, at the chapel.
Did you see these
two? Our first year at the chapel.
Jenny?
Oh yeah, we have books of past Christmas cards.
Well, I don't know about this winter, nuclear winter of 1816. That's fascinating.
I discovered that when I was writing Taste of Spruce Gum,
okay.
And was doing a certain amount of research about Vermont, and discovered that Vermont had had this 1816. And then later on, I was reading a book by Cecil Woodham Smith called The Great Hunger, which was about the big famine, 1845 to 1850.
Okay.
And it said in it, this of course was not the first famine. It was the first famine that had been caused by potato blight. But it was the first. But there had been other famines that had been caused by weather and other things. And then it listed the summer of 1816, where it had been cold over all of Europe. And then I became interested. And so then I looked up more on the summer of 1816. And by then, they had known what volcanic ash in the air does to the climate.
Where was that volcano?
It was one that I'd never heard of. It wasn't Krakatoa, which came later. In fact, I think they're having the 100th anniversary of Krakatoa or something now. Because the National Geographic, this last issue, I think, had how the foliage and the animals and things had returned to Krakatoa, what was left of it. Because it was nothing but ash, and then nobody paid any attention to it. Nobody tried to reforest it or repopulate it with any sort of animals, and so right now it's being quite a laboratory for how
natural
from nothing, how long natural restoration takes and how it works and all that. And so it wasn't Krakatoa, and apparently Krakatoa didn't cause the cold climate that some other volcanoes did. And this 1816 summer was a minor volcano as far as everybody heard about it. But then maybe you wouldn't have heard about it back then.
And they didn't tumble to the fact that it had changed their climate. They just knew they had a cold winter.
And in some remote spot, there'd been a big volcanic blow off.
Yeah.
But it hadn't affected anything much. Wasn't
volcanoes don't always blow, and I guess they blow with different degrees of soilage or power.
And Krakatoa blew and sort of obliterated a whole island or so forth, but maybe it didn't put that much ash into the air.
Yeah.
And maybe this other volcano put a lot more into the air. So I just figured maybe that was why John Dobin had come over and for the Dobins, I didn't know which one it was, but I had a date for them coming up over, and it was either 1817 or 1818. Pretty close to that famine.
Uh-huh.
Because a lot of people picked up from Vermont and headed west after that summer. After they'd had to get by on eating porcupines and crops failing and everything.
Those were the years of the Union. I mean, Ireland was actually a part of the United Kingdom, which had happened in 1801. They were trying to make Ireland as a part of Britain, and in the process, forcing around Catholic pegs and the square of Protestant homes, more particularly the Anglican fold that was the established church. And non-Anglican Protestants weren't treated very well. The Presbyterians had their problems with the established British rule. And,
wasn't that when John Bunyan was thrown into prison too? He was a non-Anglican Protestant when he wrote Pilgrim's Progress. That was 16-something.
Right? Yeah.
Okay, that was earlier.
Jonathan Swift was an Anglican Protestant, sort of an enlightened one.
Yes, show us some of your quotes.
Well, if you figure Craig was about 8 years old, why, that would have been about 1938. But he looks younger than 8. He looks more like about 6. I'd put that about 1936.
But the annotations and the notes and the side margins of this material that came to us in Biola and Leonora indicate that they were Presbyterian.
Yeah,
the McGibbonies and the Quays and the Dobbins were all Presbyterian.
I knew they were Protestants, but I didn't know Protestant what.
And which most people in Northern Ireland were, or most of the Protestants were
Scots,
were planted there or immigrated there from Scotland. But I had the disadvantage of not knowing that or not really being sure
that
I went over there and kind of narrowed it. I searched out in Ireland for the Presbyterian records. Mm-hmm. I've got a fairly extensive Presbyterian Bureau of Records there right in Belfast.
So that if I go over there, that would be something to do, to go to the Presbyterian Bureau of Records and look for John.
Or even go to the Belfast, there's a kind of a National Bureau of Records in Friend Belfast.
Like layer upon layer upon layer.
And like all other government buildings, it's heavily guarded with barbed wire and sentries. And you kind of have to get used to that to get it. Oh, yeah, it's just.
And so I would look up McGibbonies and Dogans, huh?
Yeah.
Are they?
At that point. And Buchanan's,
because
there were two Buchanan's that were over there.
Right. That's a good Scotch name.
Well, we can all of us wear the Buchanan plaid, which is quite a handsome one with lots of yellow.
Oh, really?
I've got a Buchanan plaid dress at home.
There's no McGivney plaid or a Dogan plaid.
Well, there's no Dogan plaid, because the Dogan is the Irish part.
You got it off and down.
But the McGivney, there may be a McGivney plaid. Mother said we could wear four different Scottish plaids, and one of them was Buchanan, and that would have come through Moriah and Sarah, whichever one was our direct ancestor. And I guess it would have been Sarah, who would have been John's mother. And then we have the Forbes plaid on the Wardner side.
Sarah would have been John's mother?
Well, whichever one is on that list. He married his first one, and then he married Mariah, would have been his second wife, right?
Mariah was his second wife, yeah.
Well, and Sarah would have been his mother,
his
right?
His mother, that's right, yeah.
He would have been our direct ancestor.
Is wounded already pushing it in?
Well, this is tricky.
He took a summer job, Sully Slido, farmers.
I think that Grandpa was disappointed because he was going to work on the farm, and then he didn't. But go on.
That was a story, yeah. He didn't want to work on the farm, but he got this
stamp.
Order for Slido material that he was to sell directly to farmers, and he had a 50% markup or something. He was making it pretty good money. So he started out on the road, and he went up one road and down the other, and covered the whole county, rather, mm-hmm. I guess, and sold a tremendous lot of fly dope. And so he should show my father, his father, that we're doing all right. Well, next year he didn't want to work on the farm, so he thought to repeat the fly dope business. But he got almost scalped, almost run off the farms, because of people he sold fly dope to, all the hair had gone off the cows.
Oh, gosh.
In the days before the FDA.
So he was out of the spot. He was out of the fly dope business after one season.
Something about the quays, which may or may not be fact.
But the relationship of these quays, I'm not real sure. Except that my mother heard that a child years ago, I mean this is way back in Ireland, was left on the doorstep, and because they found him on this doorstep or whatever this area was called, a quay, they named him, they gave him that as his last name. But I don't know how much of that is real and how much of it is not. And tracing these quays from those notes that my mother had, you know, I'm getting the grandparent as being the father of the grandson. I mean, and it just doesn't make sense. So I don't know. I had real problems with that, if you recall me telling you about. I said, this is impossible. He can't be his own grandson.
Too bad you can't resurrect some of the people along the way.
Well, and if we could, you know, the way, one of the things I've learned the hard way is when you write a paper and you say, my grandfather, the very beginning say, the grandfather that this article refers to is John Wesson Dogan, or whatever his name is.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happened is I have all these papers that say grandpa, I don't know who wrote them, mm-hmm. and I don't know who's grandpa.
How many generations back?
Yeah. And sometimes there's a hint in the paper somewhere that leads you to the right grandpa. But sometimes it's just absolutely impossible. When they say grandpa did this and grandpa did that, unless they signed it with their name, and you know exactly, and you can trace back to who was that person's grandpa, it's impossible. And that's what's happened. A lot of the notes that I have are like scribbled notes, and they're not definitive enough to know. But this is what my mother was told, that this quay, we're not sure how it was spelled, except that a Jane McGivney married a Henry Quay, and you can go back to a William Quay and a John Quay who had a Robert and a Samuel, and I don't know. I got a sort of a family tree. I gave you one of these, didn't I?
I think so.
But it's all question mark.
Okay, well that's all. Do you have something else?
My children were all born on the farm, and my father, Weston Joseph Dogan. Knew these children, and they played around under his feet as they were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that the story that came over when Joanne was born and back home, and he wanted to see how Vera took care of a baby, and so he just sat around and followed her around and everything she did all day long, taking care of this baby and taking care of her family. Well, then the children worked on the farm some. And Craig is a boy, the only boy. And when he was about 16 years old, he was working with my father on a field.
18.
What?
18.
And this is the story that Craig remembers with so much joy. And I remember the joy too.
This might have been in the stuff that I sent Uncle Pat. It's a sunny June day. Craig is 18. Grandpa is 80.
I'll be talking, so this is just going like this to Uncle Wesson, so he'd know what we were all saying, and then he'd speak up.
Polly telling about Grandpa talking. Grandma talking
yeah.
for Grandpa.
She'd
her fingers just flew, and she'd tell him every word that everyone was saying, so he wasn't left out of the conversation.
He had kind of a knack of getting in on the gist of things. And he must have done some different things of that.
Oh, yes, some. I mean, he went to Delavan and studied there for a little while, but he didn't read lip really. Some, must have some.
I thought maybe to get an idea of what was being discussed and what the subject was.
Did I tell you, Polly, a story about Aunt Della's funeral in Mason City?
Yeah, but tell the rest of it.
This is a story I don't think I know. I don't remember anything about Aunt Della's funeral.
Aunt Della died. Wesson's sister, Polly's grandma, right?
Right.
And she's living upstairs over Polly's
parents,
Kurt's. And we went out to the funeral.
So the wedding?
What?
Was this the wedding?
Funeral.
Oh.
Della's funeral.
Della's funeral.
And we went out to the cemetery after the funeral in the church, and it was a brief ceremony there. Golden day, just a beautiful day. And then we went up to the minister. He came up to us, and he was not embarrassed, but a little wondering what to say. And he said, my, it is a wonderful day to be laid away. And then he realized how funny that sounded, and he said, if one cared to be laid away. That's the story you remember, Polly.
I didn't realize that was at Della's funeral. I'd heard that said before, but I didn't know whose funeral that was.
And at my wedding to Jim, that was May 12, 1944, Della was a little confused at times. And she's standing there at the wedding, and then this big, loud voice, she says, who's that Roger's marrying? I was being walked into the room on the arm of my father, and she wanted to know who he was marrying. Big loud voice.
As a student at the university, and it was...
Trevor has this paper. Go on.
Philosophy or theology, but the writing, I'm just pretty impressed with the quality of the writing and the force of the writing. I'm sure that he was probably capable of delivering his sermons that were as eloquent. But he must have been a very, very good student.
I have some of those of his too, and it might be the same one Xeroxed, or it might be a different one, but I've got a sermon of his that
well,
was...
This was more of a college paper.
Oh, okay. I have a story that you wrote, or not a story...
that he left a minister in charge, and a superintendent in his job, and even a bishop, and earlier, even a bishop in the church was shifted every year. And it's only been within my lifetime that Methodist ministers stay in a place until they get thrown out, usually.
They'd move every 3-4 years, usually.
Even now. Yeah. 6 to 8, at least.
It's Terry Kinley's.
Are you folks Methodist?
Yeah. No, I'm Lutheran and Episcopalian
Gary's,
is my background.
Gary's
but my daughter went to a nursery school. It was a Lutheran church. And the ministers, they had 4 or 5.
You mean a Methodist church?
Yeah, a Methodist church, yeah. The ministers, and there must have been at least 3 or 4, they were rotated in and out regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, we've been keeping ministers there in our church now as much as 7, 8, 10 years.
Yeah. I think nowadays they're keeping them longer because it's an expense for the family to move and so forth. And also, ministers are less likely now to have parsonages available to them. It's buying and selling homes and so forth. So they're not quite as willing to uproot as maybe they used to be. Because they want that equity themselves, so they have a retirement.
Well, I've got one on his early ministry. You want to hear that one?
Yeah.
Well, let's find Grandpa's early ministry, and then maybe that's enough of...